to get Joel Beinen on.
Okay, we're all tangled up in blue here. I guess I disclaim that we're up to date on underwriting announcements. Oh, here, I'll do one in the absence of Bob Polesny. I'm still suffering from that. His family is hosting a memorial for Weft, volunteer extraordinaire, host of Sweet and Savory Blues, Roots Rock and Reggae. Monday, July 14th at 6 p.m., all are invited to gather at Poor Brothers. That's right across from the Weft Studios. Opportunity to reflect on the life and legacy of Bob, share important stories, express directly to his family how important Bob was to so many people and organizations here in Champaign and throughout the blues world. He was known widely. Put that on your calendar, 6 o'clock next Monday. And as we're right next door to, that's right next door to Weft, maybe you can come over and see where he labored so very strenuously. He really put a lot into it. And, of course, the computer wants me to tend. So Joel Beinen, I mentioned. Amy Goodman's got a commentary. I have material from Democracy Now! That was not aired, two web exclusives. Bolsonaro shows up a little bit, not so much. The longer on-air one was with a film director from Brazil, but she's also talking about evangelicals in Brazil and the comparison to here. Mumi Abu-Jamal, there were some not fresh commentaries, there were some good short commentaries, but they were historic ones, and it made me wonder whether something's going on with his health condition, so I haven't checked back this morning about that, but I'm going to try and remember to do that inside of the show, because that would be terrible if that's a problem now, too. Amy Goodman's got something that answers the question that Trump had on his visit to that terrible area in the Hill Country. Been down there once. I wasn't in the hilliest part, but right. So let's see. Amy Goodman's commentary answers the question he had is, we don't know why this happens. Well, people do know why this has happened.
The Guadalupe River flood. Blame the climate catastrophe. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The Guadalupe River in Texas gets its name, according to one popular etymology, from the Arabic phrase Wadi Alub, meaning hidden river. In the early hours of July 4th, though, the river was anything but hidden. Intense rains caused a flash flood in the middle of the night, transforming the typically quiet river into a raging torrent, rising more than 30 feet over its normal level. As the floodwaters cascaded out of the Texas Hill Country, it left a path of death and destruction in its wake. As this goes to press, there are 120 confirmed deaths and over 150 people still missing. One of the first population centers to be devastated was Camp Mystic, a storied institution founded in 1926 that hosted generations of girls from Texas's elite families. There were reportedly upwards of 750 campers, counselors, and staff present when the floodwaters crashed into the camp sometime after 3 a.m. Cabins for the youngest campers, the 8-year-olds, were closest to the river. Older campers stayed on slightly higher ground. When a wall of water 30 feet high crashes down, elevation matters. Many of the campers who died were the youngest, torn from their bunks, dragged downriver in the darkness. The flood next hit the towns of Hunt and Ingram before reaching Kerrville, destroying homes, RV parks, trees, bridges, cars, and anything else in its path. As dawn broke on the 4th of July, rescue teams began reaching impacted areas. Hundreds of people were rescued from the floodwaters, but no survivors have been found since last Friday, July 4th. Thousands of people have been scouring the debris left in the flood's wake, searching for the bodies of victims. While rescue and recovery activities proceeded, efforts to understand how this disaster happened have begun. The core of early warning for floods like this are the weather forecasting professionals at the National Weather Service, a department within NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. President Trump has gutted NOAA since taking office last January. Despite the job cuts, the NWS was able to alert local officials about likely flooding. Kerr County's top elected official, Judge Rob Kelly, admitted, "We do not have a warning system," unquote. Climate science has long acknowledged individual extreme weather events can't be directly attributed to global heating, but that the worsening climate definitely causes more intense storms and droughts and causes them more frequently. The devastating flooding of the Guadalupe River is a case in point. The region had been in drought recently, which hardens the ground, intensifying the runoff from rainstorms. The disaster occurred on the same day, July 4th, that President Trump signed the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, the Budget Reconciliation Bill.
You started with the Texas floods. We know that the climate crisis kills.
Award-winning investigative journalist Antonio Yuhas said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, commenting on the impact of the new budget law.
We also know that we have remedies. Cut fossil fuels, transition to localized renewable energy, and support frontline communities. Those programs have essentially been erased to the best extent that they could in this tax bill to remove tax incentives that would help us support solar and wind energy, manufacturing, tax breaks for consumers, producers. Those were entirely stripped away to cut out that financial support for the solar and wind transition. Tax breaks, billions of them, to the fossil fuel industry. And remember, this bill extends all of those tax cuts from 2017, which had already brought billions of dollars to the fossil fuel industry, and just gives them new benefits.
Trump's attacks on climate action will intensify the global climate catastrophe, accelerating fossil fuel drilling and burning, essentially guaranteeing more deadly extreme weather events will happen in the future. Texas is especially susceptible to climate impacts. On the day before the Guadalupe flood, the Texas Observer, one of the state's most respected investigative news outlets, published a piece by MIT Management Professor Emeritus Henry D. Jacoby, headlined, "Trump's DOGE cuts are a Texas-sized disaster," unquote. In it, Jacoby writes, quote, "Federal resources for managing climate-augmented weather disasters are being wiped out, and crucial information about future risks is being destroyed or degraded. Meanwhile, state leaders stand by while denying the seriousness of climate change as a driver of these events and the threat this poses to the state economy," unquote. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, while ignoring the role the worsening climate catastrophe is playing in the disaster that just hit Kerrville, he understands politics. To that end, he just summoned the Texas legislature back for a special session. Leading the agenda are action items to address the state's failure to prepare for the Guadalupe flood. But top of the agenda for Texas and the entire country should be the worsening climate catastrophe. Ignore that, and more severe and unpredictable weather events will only become more routine and more deadly. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, well, FEMA is apparently not on the chopping block right now. They have to wait a discreet interval, I suppose. I just checked, Mumia's health doesn't seem to have taken any turn, so I don't know why those archival pieces were put on. I'm not going to play them, but prison radio's got more and more people inside or commenting there. It's quite a vignette into another world. So I mentioned I was going to play web exclusives. I like to get all of it on the air that I can. I'm hoping to have enough time to have some Jeffrey Sachs on as well. I mentioned Jeffrey Sachs in discussion with Grant just now. Boy, I better play some material here. And he was at a conference, I guess it was in Istanbul, with the assistant secretary of state of Turkey or something like that, some honcho, talking about the whole backdrop, timber sycamore. I remember a while back he had a quote that timber sycamore was mentioned 3 times in the New York Times over the decade after it had taken place. And possibly you don't know what it was about. It was the billion-dollar CIA program to get al-Qaeda types to destabilize and regime change in Syria. So I'm hoping to have that on. And let's hear from, I guess I didn't mention, I mentioned the Brazil connection, but here's a short part two interview with the UN rapporteur, who bravely puts the Gaza situation into part one and part two, part one being the ongoing occupation and in basically incarceration before the onslaught after October 7th. She's just been reprimanded. Her assets in the U.S. have been frozen, et cetera, et cetera. Not Bibi's, but hers.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're joined now for part two of our conversation with Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Her new landmark report titled From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. The Trump administration announced Wednesday it's imposing sanctions on her, alleging she's targeting Americans and Israelis for prosecution by the International Criminal Court. She's joining us now from Slovenia's capital, Ljubljana, where she just held a news conference. Thank you so much. Much for staying with us, Nermeen.
So, Francesca, if you could talk about the companies that you name, there are dozens of them, of course, you can't list all of them, who you say in the report are profiting from Israel's war on Gaza or the expansion of illegal settlements in the West Bank. How did you compile this list? What kind of research was involved? And also explain, people are raising questions, you know, everybody understands why, you know, defense arms manufacturer Lockheed Martin is on the list, but it might be less clear why, for example, the Korean car maker Hyundai or the French bank BNP Paribas, why are they on the list? Just explain the range of companies you're looking at and the extent to which they have and in what ways enabled what Israel is doing in Gaza.
Absolutely, Nermeen. First of all, I have to say that this situation where economic actors from armed manufacturers to even universities, banks, pension funds, are part of a settler colonial endeavor of taking land and resources from people to the benefit of others is not new. This is 500 years of colonialism and settler colonialism, which has also had genocide. So what is shocking is that it's happening. It has been happening under our nose, under our eyes for so many years as the human rights system was developing. So, and companies have always escaped accountability. The only two defining moments in history when there was some accountability was after the Holocaust, with the post-Holocaust industrialist trials, where businesses and from various sectors were brought to justice. And after apartheid South Africa, where the beginning of the regulation of business sectors really advanced and produced the UN guiding principles after a few years on business and human rights. Having said that, so Israel has used and has relied on the private sector to displace and replace the Palestinians. How? Because it wouldn't have been able without weapons and without machinery to level the ground, to demolish homes, to uproot trees, to get control of the Palestinians, including by segregating them behind walls, fences, surveilling them through CCTV cameras, the automated apartheid that Amnesty International has already denounced years ago, the collection of biometric and other data, etc., etc. This is the displacement. After which comes the replacement. Companies providing tools and profiting from the providing tools to Israel to build colonies, water infrastructure, electricity grids, rails, roads, and then producing goods and services, selling them, the dates, the hahava products, or the wine from the settlements, while extracting resources from the quarries, the water, the electricity, and enclosing the Palestinians and conditioning them upon dependency, dependency at such a high cost for their life and for their development, on the dependency on the Israeli economy. And on top of it, there is the displacement, the replacement, which wouldn't be able without a web of actors who are the enablers, the banks, the pension funds, et cetera, et cetera. And also those normalizing the occupation, like with a click, like the tourism industry, Booking and Airbnb, Booking.com and Airbnb. Now, this structural, this I could have written this report decades ago. However, what has happened is in the last in the last 1 year and a half, the weapons that Israel was using to segregate, to control, to displace, to repress the Palestinians have been enhanced, have been modified. Companies have continued to provide those weapons that Israel has even customized them to make them A, more lethal, and B, less costly in terms of resources and human life for those using them. Think of the unmanned technology where you have unmanned planes and drones killing civilians, for example. Think of the, you say about Hyundai and Volvo and Caterpillar, the machinery that has been used to destroy, to demolish homes in the West Bank has been turned to help the Israeli army pulverize Gaza. It's not that Gaza has been leveled just through bombs. There have been bulldozers transforming the rubble into dust that could be cemented. And let's move on, the next stage of settler colonialism. And think of Volvo. Volvo is the company which has kept providing buses connecting the settlements. And look at the logic of the companies, because they say, but we are just selling, we don't know about the use that Israel makes, like the Norwegian speaker before. You don't need to. Israel is maintaining an unlawful occupation. Had the companies done the due diligence that they are speaking about years ago, they would have pulled out of the occupation because they were put on notice by human rights organization, Israeli, Palestinians, international, by the BDS, Who Profits, and others, of the risks that they were incurring. And they were just not registering that. And this is why today I'm telling to the companies, under international law, your obligation in terms of due diligence, which in this case should be higher due diligence, is not to be directly linked, not to contribute to, not to cause human rights impact. So guys, it's a very low threshold. Here we are not talking of impact. We are talking of violation of self-determination, annexation, and permanent occupation that if you are engaged with, you are part of one way or another. You are directly linked to, and then you must be held accountable to your consumers, first and foremost, and possibly either judges. But then there are like Elbit, IMI, and Leonardo. Leonardo is Italian. I mean, they have been with intent, knowledge, and purpose, including like companies like Palantir, providing services, technologies, and tools that have been used to enhance the killing machinery of and the killing capacity of Israel's machinery. And without the pension, sorry, without the banks and other financial institutions like BlackRock and Vanguard, Israel would have never been able to sustain its economy, which went from positive to deficit soon, I mean, between November and February, March 2024. And it's been the banks giving access to credit, helping sell Israeli bonds, and so injecting capital so that Israel could continue to invest in its economy. And now, why $70 billion have been accrued by the Israeli stock exchange in the last month? Because after the war between Israel and Iran, supported by the United States, the need to rearm, and it's clear among European countries, among Western countries. I mean, NATO is just calling member states to provide an extra 5% of their budget. And this is what is enriching the companies, who, because Israel eventually is selling this weapon, it's selling this technology. And nothing is neutral, because when you think that the European universities, for example, of American universities have cracked down so harshly the protests of the students, why? Because they were pointing the fingers on the nerve, demonstrating that if these universities were to lose the profits or the endowment they were having because of the partnership with Israeli universities or with the EU Horizon program or with the defense industry, they would probably lose a lot and go bankrupt.
I know you have to leave. What do the sanctions mean? I mean, you're speaking out everywhere. Is the United Nations supporting you, expressing support for you as their special rapporteur on the occupied Palestine territory? And can you come into the United States?
I don't know. We will see. I'm still trying to make sense of it. But what I know, and this is also the story of my land coming from south of Italy. Look, these mafia style techniques work only if we, the people, are scared and silent. If we are not scared and we are not silent and we stand united, we will be able to move the system from this horrible lawlessness and nonsense to a place of accountability. And this is what I want to stand for today.
Francesca Albanese, we want to thank you so much for being with us, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. We will link to your report from Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. The Trump administration announcing this week it's imposing sanctions on Albanese, alleging she's targeting Americans and Israelis for prosecution by the International Criminal Court. Among those who've also been sanctioned are the International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan in the last months. Francesca Albanese was joining us from Slovenia. To see part one of our conversation, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
And it's recommended viewing or listening or reading, you know. I think more people read Democracy Now! When the transcript's out than listen to it. But I may just be making that up. You're welcome to listen to it here at 4. And I have another web exclusive, and this is the one with the Brazilian woman filmmaker, where they talked about Bolsonaro. And this segment, if I'm right, is more about his evangelical support in Brazil, which I think is a factor in Argentina, too. But I'll let them lay it out, and hopefully I'll get on Joel Beinen talking about Netanyahu from up front. I think it was Wednesday, so that would mean the 2 days of meetings, which were there readouts on those? You mentioned there was the really horrible press availability with the two of them. Again, Radio for Labor coming up in a new era. Here's a web exclusive from Democracy Now! And hopefully I'm queuing up the Jeffrey Sachs segment.
We're joined now for part two of our conversation with Brazilian filmmaker Petra Costa. Her 2019 film, Edge of Democracy, was nominated for an Academy Award. It traced the rise and fall of democracy in Brazil from 1985 through the first election of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, through the years in power of the Brazil's Workers' Party, until the impeachment of Lula da Silva's protege, Dilma Rousseff, in 2017. In her new documentary, Petra Costa traces the rise of Christian nationalism in Brazil and its power in politics. It's called Apocalypse in the Tropics. Let's go to a clip from the film, which begins with images of crowds of supporters surrounding former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva after he was released from prison. He'd been jailed following a corruption conviction that was later annulled. The first voice in the clip is director Petra Costa, followed by a leading evangelical pastor and advisor to former President Bolsonaro, Silas Malafaia.
When he was sent to prison, half the country felt robbed of the chance to vote for their candidate, while the other half felt that he deserved it. Now that he was out, joy and anger had switched sides. And the memory of his 2 terms as president, where millions were lifted out of poverty, prematurely launched the next presidential race and put him ahead in every poll.
Cara, How does that happen? How is it even possible for someone to run the Workers' Party while in prison? Are you really going to tell me that a guy like this, when he was president and had the power in his hands, had nothing to do with this corruption? That's a joke. I'm going to grab some coffee. That's a joke. This is outrageous. This is nothing but a vanity show from the minister.
What do you think is going to happen in 2022?
He's going to lose the election. You know why? He's screwed in the evangelical world. He's screwed in the evangelical world. Completely screwed. You can quote me on that. And there's over 30. We're over 30% of the population. It's not going to work for him.
That last voice, Silas Malafaia, is a well-known evangelical, very influential Brazilian evangelical pastor, one of the focuses of Petra Costa's new film, Apocalypse in the Tropics. Thank you so much for staying for part two of this conversation. So we're talking to you when your film is just a big deal because it's come out and it's so remarkable to President Trump and the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, putting 50% tariff on Brazilian products unless the former disgraced president of Brazil, Bolsonaro's trial is ended, who was involved with, is being charged with being involved with the attempted coup of January 8th. But I want to go to Lula, the current president. Mm-hmm. He's outraged by what President Trump is trying to do, interfering with the internal affairs of the country. But we just showed that clip of him coming out of prison. Talk about him being jailed, being cleared, and becoming president again of Brazil, and yet where the evangelical force is standing today and opposing him, and his response to that, because you have an amazing conversation with him.
Yeah, so Brazil Lula was allied with evangelicals during his government. The evangelical population grew 135% during the Workers' Party's government. And in 2016, precisely when I was making The Edge of Democracy, that alliance broke, and evangelicals started to support, soon after, far-right president Jair Messias Bolsonaro, and helped elect him, declaring him to be the Messiah in many cases. His attempted assassination was used as a sign of God, was interpreted as a sign of God that Bolsonaro would then save the nation, was chosen by God to save the nation.
Very similar to Trump.
Trump would use a similar rhetoric a few years later. I don't know how inspired he was by the rhetoric of Bolsonaro, but it's really uncanny, the similarities. Then Lula, when I interview him, he says something very interesting, which is he thinks that the mistake of socialism was denying religion. And what I think Lula is getting at is what much of our film hasn't discovered, the investigation that we did discovered, which is that since the 70s and 80s, with the decline of liberation theology and of the Catholic Church and the rise of prosperity theology and then dominion theology, the space of religion has been occupied more and more by the far right. And Lula is basically saying what other people are saying, which is that there's no empty space in politics. So when people lose faith in democracy, when the Catholic Church is in decline, that space is occupied by the far right. And that's the situation in Brazil right now. In the last election, 2022, when Bolsonaro lost, he had 70% of the evangelical vote. That was more than in any other segment, if you count for race, class, everything. And that same 70% now disapproves of Lula's government. What it shows is a phenomenon where people are voting less and less for their economic interest and more based on moral values. Moral values that are very inspired by the spread of misinformation. The most spread misinformation in the last election was that Lula would close churches and ban unisex bathrooms.
Very similar to what we're seeing here in the United States.
I think very inspired by what has been happening in the United States. Yeah.
So could you explain, Petra, you mentioned, why did evangelicals break with Lula? And also give us a sense of the, you know, we get some of that from the film, the range and diversity of people in Brazil who are evangelicals or support the evangelical movement.
The evangelical movement in Brazil has changed quickly in the last years. It was mainly a working class religion, and now it's reaching more and more the upper classes as well, tied also to the rise of agribusiness and that culture. And the reason why evangelicals broke with Lula is, they say, Silas says, was that when the Workers' Party decided to embrace a more minority rights agenda, defending trying to pass a law that would forbid homophobia, which Dilma approved and supported, and things of that sort. There are other narratives that
attribute that more into a war of taxation, some churches not wanting to pay the necessary taxes. And what Bolsonaro gave the greatest tax exemption to pastors and evangelical churches during his government, and gave them really complete access to the presidential palace. And that's why we see a marriage that it still stands to this day. Even with Bolsonaro ineligible, most evangelical, prominent evangelical leaders continue to support him and any far-right candidate that he will decide. Last weekend, we saw a rally that was organized by Malafaia asking for Bolsonaro's pardon for the coup attempt. And in that rally, Bolsonaro says, it doesn't matter who is the president. Give me 50% of the Congress and I will change the destiny of this nation.
And actually explain, how many evangelicals are there now?
26%.
In Congress?
And no, 26% of the population is evangelical, 20% of Congress is evangelical.
So let's go to the clip of Bolsonaro speaking at a rally just 2 weeks ago.
We can solve Brazil's problems. Let me repeat, give me 50% of the Chamber of Deputies and 50% of the Senate, and I will change Brazil's destiny.
So here is Bolsonaro. He's actually on trial, right, for the attempted coup. But explain what he's talking about here.
Well, he's giving a messianic message that it doesn't matter who is elected president, he will change the destiny of the country. And I think it's very aligned with this dominionist theology of taking over the three branches of government. And right now, Brazil's Congress is the most conservative Congress in Brazil's history. And we see a war taking place where the government, Lula's government, is currently trying to tax the rich. Brazil is one of the countries that least taxes the rich in the world. We're one of the most unequal countries in the planet. The Congress is not giving in to the idea of taxing the rich. And for you to have an idea, taxing the ultra rich in Brazil, which would be 50 families, would bring $230 billion into the government. So that's what we have, a very conservative Congress that is immobilizing the government in many ways and not allowing for the government to pass bills in favor of the population.
And if you could give, you said 26% of Brazil's population is evangelical. How does the rest of the population break down in terms of political orientation? I mean, your film, as you mentioned earlier as well, you know, it kind of tracks the breakdown of the secular ideal in Brazil, which I think is mirrored elsewhere as well. You know, so how much would you say of the Brazilian electorate is still committed to that idea, the separation of church and state, which you talk about in the film, versus this 26% who are evangelical?
Around 50% or more of the population is Catholic, identifies as Catholic. The thing is that what we found in this film is that a great part, even of the evangelical electorate, is very unsatisfied with this mixture of religion and politics, because persecution has been happening in churches against anyone who speaks against Bolsonaro. I portray in the film a pastor called Paulo Marcelo. That pastor says he was expelled from his church after declaring that he would not support Bolsonaro and that he would vote for Lula. I know a gospel singer who was one of the most famous gospel singers in Brazil, who's now exiled out of the country and is not invited to speak to sing in any church because of the religious persecution. So we're seeing religious persecution happening in Brazil more than ever in terms of Christians persecuting Christians for having different political views. And what the investigation of this film uncovered for me is that the separation of church and state was precisely invented by Christians to protect Christians from religious persecution.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to a clip of the coup for people to have full context about the parallels in January 8th and how that informs so much of what's happened today. This is after Bolsonaro lost. And let's go to it right now.
Jogando bomba para dispersar.
Eles acabam de escrever.
So Bolsonaro loses at the end of 2022, his run for the presidency. And this took place in 2023, January 8th. And this has led to the trial of Bolsonaro for the attempted coup. Explain who is involved with this. We're so familiar with these images, not to be confused with, though, January 6th in Washington, D.C. And then talk about what you're hoping people will take away from this film. You say for global audiences, for people here in the U.S., as they view this on Netflix, for example, that you see it as a parable.
Yes, I really see this film as a parable of our times, where we have leaders that are trying to destroy democracy from within at a time of climate collapse, at a time where the crisis of capitalism have reached an edge, instead of proposing solutions for a world that is in danger and going towards ultimate collapse. They're actually trying to accelerate that collapse. And that has very much to do with this apocalyptic theology that was at play at our January 8th attack. Many of the people, not all of them, were evangelical fundamentalists who believed that accelerating the end of the world and accelerating chaos will accelerate the second coming of Jesus Christ. That is an apocalyptic belief that is useful for leaders such as Bolsonaro, such as Trump. And many of these believers believe that Bolsonaro and Trump are positive because they will precisely accelerate the end of the world. And for these leaders, I think the interest is to destroy the democratic institutions that regulate and basically tax their profit and the profit of their allies. They would like to have a world with no democracy so that they can have unlimited power and unlimited surplus
And yet you have Lula today, just at the BRICS summit, saying this.
So we don't want an emperor. Our countries are sovereign. If Trump issues tariffs, other countries have the right to do the same. There is the reciprocity law. I think it's not responsible for a president from a country like the United States to threaten the world with tariffs on social media. Honestly, there are other forums for the president of a country the size of the United States to talk to other countries.
So that's President Lula saying there is no room for emperors in the world today.
Exactly. We're seeing this fight between some leaders who are defending democracy, who are defending a world that would share its profit with the population that needs it the most, with some leaders trying to return to a kind of absolutist divine rule that we have lived through, and it led to nothing but holy wars. That was what the Middle Ages were, like centuries of holy wars with nations trying to kill other nations simply from being from another denomination, another religious denomination. But I think this discourse is gaining traction because people are perceiving that the neoliberal order is failing their dreams, is failing their aspirations. So while you have some progressive movements not actually offering a solution, but being positioning themselves as managers of the crisis of capitalism, you have the far right positioning itself as anti-system. Let's destroy the system. But what they want to put it in place, in its place, is something that has already been in its place and proved to not really work, which is divine rule. Do we want to go to that? I believe there are some other progressive voices that are proposing more proactive changes that will improve people's livelihoods. And I hope that path will be more and more explored in the times to come, rather than really this position of managing the crisis of capitalism, which has clearly led us to this dead end.
And in the film, you also, because there is a more emancipatory strain of theology that existed in Brazil, as it did all across Latin America, which is a liberation theology. So if you could explain, track the movement that you do in the film of how this apocalyptic theology, what you just called it, evangelical Christianity, how that crushed liberation theology.
Well, there's many different types of evangelicalism. There are many progressive pastors in Brazil. There were evangelicals involved in liberation theology. But yes, liberation theology was a movement in the 60s and 70s that preached for social justice and the emancipation of people who were oppressed in what, as I call Brazil, one of the most unequal nations in the world. That was seen as a threat by the United States. At that moment, Kissinger said that it proved the Catholic Church was no longer an ally of the United States. And evangelical missionaries started to be sent to Brazil, specifically also we uncovered by this lobbying group called The Family, also known as The Fellowship, to convert congressmen into evangelicalism. That was unreported. That was thanks to the research of our amazing investigative journalist, Nicolas Iglesias, that we were able to uncover. And then Brazil developed its own brand of evangelicalism that is now being exported to Latin America, Africa, and even to the United States.
If you could talk about how you got involved with this film, the beginning of the film, this incredible moment in Congress where you have evangelicals kind of almost like having a seance or blessing the Congress.
So I'm the same age as Brazilian democracy, as I say in my previous film, The Edge of Democracy. And I thought that in our 30s, we would be standing on solid ground. When the crisis in 2016 began, I went to Brazilian Congress to try to understand what was happening. And instead of finding congressmen debating the impeachment, I was met by a pastor who handed me a Bible and told me that I should accept Jesus and attempted to bless and evangelize my entire crew. The contradiction of going to the center of democracy and being almost cornered into converting into evangelicalism was what made me want to make this film. And at that moment, I perceived the immense influence that particularly evangelical fundamentalism was having in Brazilian politics, which was not really investigated to the extent of the power of that movement has at this moment.
Do you have any hope?
I do have hope. I think the main thing is for us to really ensure the separation of church and state, both in the United States and in Brazil, create new mechanisms. Democracy is a living thing, and its current threats, be it from the tech companies, the social media platforms, unregulated capitalism, and the rise of religious fundamentalism, means that democracy will only survive if we're able to create mechanisms that will regulate these new threats. And that's also has much in common, democracy has much in common with many principles that are in the New Testament. Love thy neighbor, the idea that God is not for just the chosen people, but for everyone. That's the principle of democracy, to be able to have a coexistence with your enemy, even if your enemy is weaker than you.
We're going to leave it there. I thank you very much for being with us. But folks shouldn't leave it there. They should see Apocalypse in the Tropics. Petra Costa is the Oscar-nominated, Peabody-winning Brazilian filmmaker. And that is her new film. It's out on Netflix next week. Her previous film, The Edge of Democracy. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. To see part one of this discussion, go to democracynow.org.
Okay. As she implied, this was a web exclusive, part two, that interview, Brazilian filmmaker. Not a film directly on Bolsonaro, but on his manipulation of his evangelical, a higher percentage than in this country, I think. To get all of this on, I'll be excerpting Joel Beinan. Here he's talking about Bibi Netanyahu, and then I'm hoping to get Jeffrey Sachs up, talking about the backstory of the regime change in Syria and Timber Sycamore, CIA operation under Obama, $1 billion of money spent into arming al-Qaeda types, et cetera, et cetera. Up front is with Brian Edwards Tiekert. I guess he introduces himself here. He's got a great relationship with Joel Beinan, who is Emeritus Professor of Middle East Studies from Stanford, hanging out in Eugene, I guess it is. Or is it Portland?
There was a renewed call-up of reservists back in March when Israel unilaterally violated the ceasefire that had been negotiated in January between Hamas and Israel. So something like 60, 70,000 reservists were called up to enable Israel to resume assaulting the northern Gaza Strip, which it has continued to do. Focus is now around Khan Yunis, where four or five Israeli soldiers were reported killed in fighting with Hamas units just yesterday, I think it was.
And was there no additional call-up associated with the bombardment of Iran?
No, because that was undertaken primarily by the Air Force and by the elite digital intelligence unit, Unit 8200, and other such units. So those soldiers were already mobilized. Now, when they call up pilots, a lot of them are on reserve, but pilots who are eligible for active duty not usually train one day a week. So being called up to do a bombing run on Iran is almost routine for the pilots.
So those kind of call-ups in a small country, they take people away from their jobs, their families, their communities. They have an economic impact and a social impact. Is there any sign of public fatigue over the perpetual war footing?
There are signs. The Israeli economy is not doing well. The value of the new Israeli shekel, the currency, has dropped. Tens of thousands of highly educated Israelis have left the country. They've gone to Athens, to Berlin, to Toronto. And the country is overwhelmingly against the war at this point. Not everyone is united around what that means, but at a minimum, some 70% of the population, according to recent public opinion polls, of the Jewish population, we should specify, is in favor of ending the war and making a comprehensive deal for the exchange of captives. The hang-up on that has always been because that deal was on the table as early as November, December of 2023. The hang-up has always been Netanyahu's insistence on total victory and the complete defeat of Hamas. Both objectives are impossible. It was understood by many people, myself included, that those were unrealizable objectives early on. But now even centrist Israeli media commentators with military connections have begun to say this in public.
But still, the public opinion polling inside Israel of Israeli Jews, that's showing support for a ceasefire and exchange of hostages, not support for anything that most Palestinians would recognize as something like justice.
Oh, right. Of course. There is a vast difference, a huge gap between what Israeli public opinion envisages as a reasonable and long-term resolution of the issue and what the Palestinian public, both under occupation, citizens of Israel and in the diaspora, would be willing to support. We're nowhere near a comprehensive settlement for that reason.
These repeated massacres at aid distribution points where Israeli forces and private security forces fire into the crowds of people crowding for food, have they penetrated media coverage in Israel in a way that seems to have any impact on public opinion of how the war is being prosecuted?
No. If you are an Israeli Jew, you can choose to consume media that barely mentions the deaths of Gaza civilians. You can also have access to Haaretz and Plus 972 and BBC in Hebrew and other sources that will inform you of what most of the rest of the world sees and knows. But the overwhelming public culture and public discourse in Israel simply doesn't pay any real attention to civilian deaths in Gaza.
All right, Dovana, let's talk about Benjamin Netanyahu's third trip to Washington, D.C. of the Trump presidency. He is leaving a country at war, flying halfway around the world to nominate a truly buffoonish public figure for the Nobel Peace Prize. I get why he might want to suck up to Donald Trump. I don't understand how this could possibly play well with the Israeli public. How has his trip been covered back home?
So first, Trump is actually quite popular in Israel because Israelis, many Israelis, there's always, of course, a difference of opinion, but many Israelis see Trump as the one responsible for the ceasefire that did come into existence on January 19th. If we remember, Trump said that he wanted to see a ceasefire in place before he was inaugurated, and there was. And in addition, the United States somehow negotiated a side deal by directly negotiating with Hamas for the release of the one living dual citizen Israeli-American hostage, Eden Alexander. So in the eyes of a very large number of Israelis, Trump is heroic, the one who forced Netanyahu to agree to a deal that brought back some of the hostages, and both in demonstrations of Israelis and American Jews in Washington that occurred to greet Netanyahu as he arrived in Washington, and in parallel demonstrations in Israel, people are calling on Trump to push Netanyahu or force Netanyahu to make the deal. So there's a deep a chasm between the understanding of American liberals and progressives of what Trump is, including liberal and progressive Jews, and the majority of Israeli Jews. They're just on two different wavelengths about this.
The top lines that have been reported out about the deal in the works is that it would be a 60-day ceasefire during which there would be a release of 10 living Israeli hostages from Gaza and 9 bodies. Precious little else in terms of details. The big question would be, how does that move towards a more enduring ceasefire or truce?
Right. And that is one of the key points of difference. Netanyahu does not want to agree to a ceasefire that in any way would bind Israel to transform the ceasefire into a more enduring agreement to end the war. The other points of difference that were reported when the deal was first announced, a deal which, again, could have been had many months ago, were differences over whether the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation will continue to be responsible for distributing aid to the civilian population, or whether UN agencies and others that were engaged in aid distribution before Israel violated the ceasefire in March would resume doing that. Second big issue is where Israeli troops would retreat to when the ceasefire came into existence. Hamas wanted Israel to withdraw to the positions that it held as of March 18th, when the ceasefire was violated by Israel. Israel, of course, doesn't want to do that, because then what was the point of them violating the ceasefire and seizing bigger portions of the Gaza Strip? In the Israeli media, that has been reported as a disagreement over whether Israeli troops could remain in the Morag axis, which is a second east-west axis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip between Rafah and Khan Yunis. The dots are not being connected, that the reason that the Israeli government wants to maintain Israel's military control over the Morag axis is that that will allow it to implement the plan announced by Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz, who is not a member of one of the fascist messianist parties, but is a loyal Likudist Netanyahu supporter. And he announced a plan in which Israel will level the ruins of the Gaza Strip and build on it what he has called a humanitarian city, which will house 600,000 people. And that would essentially be a concentration camp, because Israel would screen for security all the people who would enter into that humanitarian city, as it is very misleadingly being called. And then they wouldn't be able to leave. So basically, voluntary entrance into a prison where people will at least nominally be fed and given medical care. But then they are locked up for who knows how long. So that plan is still on the table, even though Netanyahu isn't publicly speaking a great deal about it.
According to the reporting in Haaretz, it was a plan to move 600,000 Gazans there immediately, but eventually to move the whole population of the Gaza Strip, about 2 million people.
Right. That the broader notion behind this is that somewhere south of Khan Yunis, a line will be drawn and all the Gazans will be dumped into that area, perhaps as little as a fifth of the already tiny area of the Gaza Strip. I mean, of course, this is a major international crime of ethnic cleansing, but that doesn't bother the Israeli government very much.
The fact that the defense minister is talking about this plan publicly, does that mean that the Israeli government is actually prepared to allocate funds for construction of something in Gaza, or just that they are going to herd people into a tent city?
So the Minister of Defense Israel Katz, has ordered the army to prepare this plan. It's not clear if a budget has been allocated to it. It's certainly not clear how they could make it happen. They could, of course, deploy sufficient violence to make it happen if that's what the government decides to do. So as with many plans that have been announced about Gaza, it's unclear what is happening here. Netanyahu tried to flatter Trump by saying that this plan is consistent with the plan that Trump announced back in January, that the United States would somehow acquire the Gaza Strip and turn it into an Eastern Mediterranean Riviera. But Trump hasn't spoken about that very much since those days. So who knows what Trump is prepared to accept or not.
But, I mean, the plan as described by its progenitor, it would clear out 80% of the land area of the Gaza Strip of Palestinians. That presumably means it would open it up for something, a military garrison, Jewish-Israeli settlement, or something else.
Right.
Is there a big push to reestablish settlements inside Gaza?
There are elements of the government that have been promoting that idea from very early on. There was a conference held just outside the northern borders of the Gaza Strip many months ago to promote the idea of the resettlement of the Gaza Strip by Jewish settlers. There certainly is a far right-wing public movement to promote this. The Israeli military authorities understand that this is a security nightmare and would just get in the way. So there's a more modest, equally criminal, but more modest plan, the general's plan that the military has promoted, which would be to militarily occupy the northern portion of the Gaza Strip and leave much more of the Gaza Strip for Palestinians to resettle themselves on. It's unclear which of these approaches the Israeli government may finally adopt. The factors that will determine what will happen are the political preferences of the parties in the coalition. And that will be further affected by whether or not Netanyahu decides to seek early elections. So in a couple of weeks, the Knesset will go on recess for the summer. If Netanyahu decides he's done with this current government and wants to, for example, make a deal with Gaza that over Gaza that doesn't involve permanent military occupation, and that would mean that the two messianist fascist parties would leave the government and the government would risk falling, and then Netanyahu would call an early election, and he's been strengthened by the Israeli successes in Iran, so he might figure that this is the best way for him to stay in power. So that's one scenario. Another factor that will determine what happens is what the military authorities say. I mean, they are the ones who are going to have to enforce whatever it is, so their opinion about what will work and what won't work will be important. A third factor is what President Trump may or may not approve of, and he may approve of something today and approve of something rather different tomorrow. That's pretty difficult to second guess. So I'd say a lot of balls are still in the air, and we don't know where they're going to fall down.
Joel Beinan, Emeritus Professor of Middle East Studies. I like that line, messianic fascist parties, for his descriptors for a couple of the parties in Netanyahu's coalition. So I'm going to play an excerpt of Jeffrey Sachs. I hope we get to the salience. CIA Operation Timber Sycamore created the Syrian crisis. This is from Economic Times. I think it's a journal out of Turkey, where he's speaking, I believe, in Istanbul.
To call it a tremendous victory, I mean, one way to understand Netanyahu's visit to Washington this week is that it's a victory lap, and Netanyahu.
Okay, that doesn't seem to want to pause. And playing from the internet is not always the best deal. So I guess I'll play Jeffrey Sachs on the U.S. real role in Syria tomorrow, since by that time I'll put it on something that's immediate to me. Why don't I do a cultural announcement and play a couple of underwriting announcements? Why don't I do the underwriting announcement now? Again, opinions are those of the speakers, and that was Joel Beinan with Brian Edwards Tekert, my go-to guy. They have a great rapport. The show is called Upfront. It's available as a freestanding podcast, as is Corona Calls, every Monday feature of Brian Edwards Tekert that I advise people to listen to if they're still concerned about the new variant of COVID and maybe even the old one.
Programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. Tanner Friedman is a public relations agency with a focus on media relations, crisis communications, and brand messaging. They also possess capabilities in video production, web design, and event promotion. More information on the firm and its work is at tannerfriedman.com.
Okay, now the cultural thing is July 21st through 26th, Urbana, Illinois, Tango Week. See You Tango. It's a great outfit. Kicks off with a movie night at the Gallery Art Bar, faculty and guest concert at the Rose Bowl. I know the Bendo local 12, 13-piece tango band called Bandeon Massacre is playing out at the Rose Bowl at some point. I'm thinking that was tomorrow, but check your local listings. Here's another underwriting announcement since I missed it. This is from another small local business. Appreciate their support. Do support community media.
WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's ELLIOTT Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Radio Free Labor on WEFT, Champaign Urbana, listener sponsored, volunteer operated radio. That hits all the spots. And here's Radio Free Labor. Please listen.